All right. Well, welcome everybody. Really great to see so many people here this evening. My name is Jordan. I'm one of the organizers with Corona Contract. Just to give you a brief overview of the plan for tonight, I'm just going to give a quick overview of who we are. May will introduce our speakers. Then we'll have the speakers give their talks for about 20 minutes or so. Then we'll take some questions from the audience. And then we're going to split out into breakout rooms for about 20 minutes to have discussions amongst one another, because this is intended to be a quite practical training event. And then after those breakout rooms, we'll come back together as a group, discuss the outcomes of those meetings, and then have a closing speech, all of which should stay under an hour and 20 minutes. And we're going to try and keep strict to time so that people don't get too much Zoom fatigue. So as I said, my name is Jordan. I am a fixed-term researcher at Birkbeck and one of the organizers and authors of the Corona Contract. I'm sure most of you know what this is, but just to remind you, we put out an open letter at the very beginning of lockdown, putting out the demand for casualized workers at universities to have their contracts extended for at least 2 years. We kind of predicted at the beginning of lockdown that we were facing a serious crisis for our jobs and for the jobs of all staff in higher education. We anticipated that there would be hiring freezes, and of course this is happening, and that there would be backlash from management and redundancies, and this is the crisis that we're now in. We have had the Corona Contract has functioned as a kind of galvanizing force for universities all over the UK and indeed internationally. A number of universities have passed motions, UC branches have passed motions supporting Corona Contract, and it's served as an impetus for people to meet, to organize, to fight back in their local context in order to protect jobs. And that's something we're really pleased about and that we're trying to push forward. We've had motions passed as well at the highest levels of UCU decision-making, such as the NEC, we're carrying on the battle both within our universities and at the national level. There's two really important things that we think are the priority for the campaign. One is, of course, the offer from our employers over the Four Fights dispute, which includes casualization, as well as pay and inequality and a number of other things. We think it's absolutely vital that we get out the message that this paltry offer needs to be rejected, and that the argument needs to be made over and over again clearly why it's essential that we reject this offer and we strategize ways to withhold our labor and continue the fight in order to secure our jobs and to secure fair pay and decent working conditions. There's lots of local disputes happening, and we want to continue strengthening those. And one of the best ways to do that is for this dispute to remain a national dispute. And also at this particular time, it's increasingly clear that our employers are particularly vulnerable. They're dependent on our goodwill to push learning online and asking us to undertake all kinds of work that's not being compensated for fairly. And we think not only is it necessary that we reject the Four Fights offer, but that we're in a particularly advantageous position to fight back against it, because right now the power lies with us as workers to say we reject the marketized education model and we have a better way of doing things. The other crucial kind of component to all of this is, of course, outside of official industrial action, strategizing ways that we can continue to organize besides the kind of traditional balloting process. And that's what this meeting tonight is going to be about. I think one of the key things is that we now have, it looks like, 62 participants all over the UK. And we need to get the word out about the different ways that people can and should organize within their departments and within their universities. I was involved in the Get Out the Vote effort for the last industrial dispute at Birkbeck, and learned just how valuable and important it is, and often overlooked it is, to reach out to your colleagues, both those who you think are sympathetic and those who you think need a bit more kind of persuasive conversations, whether that's writing to people individually, writing emails, personal appeals, sending text messages, WhatsApp messages, however you do it, it's easy to forget that people aren't always paying attention to the wider situation and the fact of redundancies, of casualized staff being laid off, of permanent staff being forced to take on more work than they are contracted to. And a brilliant outcome of tonight would be if everybody manages to get in touch with at least three people about the permanent staff solidarity pledge that we've put out there, gets them to sign it, gets them to commit to implementing the actions in it, and gets those people to then contact three more people. It's really as simple as that, just kind of spiraling outwards the kinds of actions and demands that we've put forward. So I am going to leave it at that and let Ame introduce our speakers.
Okay, hi. Yeah, so we've got some great speakers lined up. And we'll hopefully just keep it to about 5 minutes per speaker if we can, because we're going to try to give enough time for people to ask questions. Again, this should be very hands-on. We have Shelley Asquith, who's a health, safety, and well-being officer at the TUC. Do you mind speaking first, Shelley?
No, I don't mind at all. I'll try my best to keep it to 5 minutes, but it might be a little bit longer. Hi everybody, thanks for inviting me. I just want to start by extending solidarity to everyone here, whatever your particular employment situation. I think this campaign in uniting the workforce under shared concerns is really important, and I really admire how you've brought it together through the rank and file, all while kind of being isolated from one another. And I appreciate the real leverage that members have over the summer months in resisting universities and colleges' plans to cut jobs and hours, will be in your power to withhold your labour through marking boycotts or work to rule or whatever else it is you guys have planned. But I've been asked to bring in the health and safety angle, which may well provide another weapon in your armoury, or at least I hope anyway. And when it comes to the situation facing a number of industries where large numbers of redundancies or even just high numbers of continuing absences for various reasons risk shifting more work onto remaining colleagues, we need to be just as live to the preventing of exposure to the invisible hazard that is coronavirus as we are to the invisible issue that is stress. Now, the Health and Safety Executive, which is the regulator, defines stress as the adverse reaction people have to excessive pressures or other types of demand placed on them at work. There is a clear distinction between pressure, which can be a motivating factor, and stress, which can occur when this pressure becomes excessive. And our own research at the TUC found that union members say the biggest causes of stress are workload, cuts in staff, changes at work, and long hours, in that order. Previous research also shows that education workers are one of the occupations that report the highest rates of total cases of work-related stress, depression, or anxiety, second only to healthcare workers. So the prospect of this crisis in FE and HE worsening poses a serious risk to people's mental and physical well-being. A little warning now, as I'm going to mention a case of suicide. Perhaps you're familiar with the very sad case of Dr. Anderson from Cardiff University. He left two notes behind before he fell from the university building, one to his family and another referring to work pressures and long hours. According to his wife, he was working evenings, weekends and holidays to keep on top of marking, preparing lectures, setting exam papers and answering emails. The paperwork from his appraisals in the years preceding his suicide showed he had been unable to take leave due to workload, and he had made management aware that his workload was unmanageable, but nothing had changed. So the tragic outcome is the reality we need to be reminding management of and doing everything we can to safeguard against. Often when it comes to reps supporting members with stress and mental health concerns, it can end up kind of functioning like a counsellor-client relationship. And while it's important that members have someone to reach out to in the union, particularly if there's no support from management, which often there isn't, for us to be able to push back, we have to be able to collectivise this as an issue. And one of the key roles of union reps, especially union health and safety reps, is to engage in the risk assessment process. Where members are identified as needing additional support, reps can negotiate a number of adjustments, including working hours. And if colleagues are having adjustments made to mitigate against stress, it's hard to see how management can expect the majority of work to continue being done while also sacking a proportion of the workforce. The advice page on the Queen Mary UCU website, which I imagine a lot of you will have seen, is really good on this, and it's questions to raise with management. And when it comes to risk assessments, management should not be wriggling free. The Management of Health and Safety at Work Regulations 1999, and please flag with me if I jargony, comrades, I try not to do so. It imposes a duty on employers to conduct a risk assessment to identify and mitigate against health and safety hazards of both employees and non-employees, i.e. students. The Health and Safety Executive Stress Management Standards are the recommended method when demanding a thorough process that includes stress if you're a rep and you're going through that process. The first standard it identifies is demands, which includes workloads. The second is control, which asks how much say you have over the way that you work. And these are the two where I'd be highlighting serious cause for concern in your sector. I know of only one university, although there may well be others, which implemented the standards, and it saw a fall by more than 20% in the days taken as absence due to stress. In respect of stress, assessments are essential in an environment where there is a known risk of stress or where a particular employee has been known to suffer from stress in the past, and a failure to comply with the regulations can lead in a criminal prosecution. It's important in these cases that concerns about mental health are raised beforehand by yourselves, because foreseeability is a key test in a case. Although I appreciate with raising issues comes the fear of repercussions and leaves people vulnerable to discrimination, which is why corporate mental health campaigns about awareness raising are not always in the best interests of workers. But it might be one idea that this campaign urges UCU members en masse to report to management and to report to the union concerns about mental health in a sort of I am stress Spartacus kind of way. And there are examples of workers winning up to hundreds of thousands of pounds in damages in court over cases of work-related stress, including one teacher who received £250,000, not quite as high as a vice chancellor's salary, but those are very stressful jobs, we're told. There are a couple of cases, case law examples that I can share if that would be helpful in terms of compiling examples of things to show management that this is by far from in their own interest when the workforce is organised and ready to resist these measures. I would also say that as well as generic risk assessments, we should be asking management to ensure personalised risk assessments take place, which take into account any vulnerabilities a person might have, as well as their home working environment if they're expected to continue working from home. And on top of risk assessments, it's also worth pressing management to be conducting equality impact assessments, both on any redundancy proposals and also on any new contracts or changes to working practices. If they resist, you could always go ahead and do your own. And I know some branches have already pointed to the disproportionate impact that plans have on Black and women members. And of course, the reputational damage of the accusation of institutional racism and institutional sexism may help keep up the pressure. I'm going to finish by talking briefly about Section 44 of the Employment Rights Act. And comrades, again, pull me up if I get jargony. Now, Section 44 isn't simply the right to walk off the job, as it's sometimes framed as, but it is the right to protection from detriment were you to do so. So you have the right not to be dismissed, disciplined, or have your pay cut because you complain about unsafe working conditions or leave work when you believe yourself to be in real or imminent danger. That includes complaints about stress at work. Although it has yet to be tested, to my knowledge, but if an employee, and I should make that distinction, the law applies to employees, so it doesn't, for example, include the self-employed. But if an employee is so overworked or otherwise stressed that they're on the verge of a nervous breakdown and reasonably believe that to continue working in those conditions will push them over the edge, the situation may well fall within that section of the law. But another way to see it would be to consider whether not withdrawing from the workplace in such circumstances would constitute a breach of your statutory duty under Section 7 of the Health and Safety at Work Act, which requires you to take reasonable care for your own health and safety. So there you have it. I'm going to leave it there for now, at least, but I look forward to hearing from the other speakers and answering any questions that might come up.
Great. Thank you so much, Shelley. Next, we have Sanaz Raji. Sanaz is an independent researcher and the founder of UNI's Resist Border Controls, which is a national campaign opposed to the hostile environment policy and border controls in UK higher education.
Thank you so much for inviting UNI's Resist Border Controls. Cuiva is supposed to be here this evening, so I'm filling in lieu of Cuiva Mater McGuinness, who some of you may know. I think I'm going to briefly go into some aspects of the hostile environment that we saw preliminary through our study that we done in 2018 on how hostile environment is practiced within UK higher education. One of the major statistics that we found was that hostile environment was affecting Black minority ethnic staff who are migrants within higher education disproportionately more so than their white international peers. And I think, and I'm seeing it as I, but I think the rest of URBC, and I'm just conferring some of the notes from Cuiva, I think there is a real belief that with the coming of COVID and everything else that has transpired in the last couple of months, we will see a further push of Black minority ethnic staff who will be made redundant first before their white international peers. And that's something that we are very concerned about amongst migrant staff. One of the other things we wanted to bring up in this talk was about Tier 4 students who are caught up in Corona contracts or contracts that are tied to their degrees. So as some of you may know, Tier 4 students are allowed to work. They're allowed to work up to 20 hours a week, but many of them have been made redundant. Some of them have not been given furlough. And as a result, their families are taking out enormous loans to be able to send their, you know, and be able to sustain their children in the UK. Some of them have been placed in enormous levels of debt. Other students have also had issues around the fact that some of them didn't have, weren't actually working contracts within the university, but actually working in zero contract hour jobs. And those have been made redundant and not given any furlough. They were made redundant before furlough came into effect. And so they actually have no ability to sustain themselves in the UK at the moment. Now, I think some of the people in this channel are very familiar that in the last 2 months, URBC has put out a COVID mutual aid fundraiser, and thus far I think we've raised something like over £4,000, so thank you everyone who's given us some of the money. The funds are going to Tier 4 students who are impacted because of no recourse to public funds. No recourse to public funds is an obvious issue that Tier 4 students are, and I don't want to just say Tier 4 students, but all migrants who are subject to immigration controls are unfortunately have problems accessing. And what we have seen with this is that many of the students are not able to sustain themselves. So even if their university has given them hardship grants, unfortunately, that's a one-off thing and they're back to where they've started, which is the fact that they don't have any funds coming in from their families who are also in lockdown in various countries. And now they're in a situation where they don't have any money coming in and they're left basically being made redundant. And so no recourse to public funds is one of the issues that URBC is trying to fight at the moment. And actually just a few minutes ago, we put out two letters, one around no recourse to public funds, ending no recourse to public funds for Tier 4 students. And the other, which I'll get into, is around a tuition fee amnesty. Now, we've also seen as a result of students being left destitute because of COVID, a lot of universities are now asking up front for the tuition fees. So if the students were paying in installment tuition fees, they're now being told if they don't pay their tuition fees by a certain date, a certain deadline, they are going to have an access suspension. And if they don't pay after the access suspension, they'll be essentially removed off their course. Now, what people tend to forget is that if you're a Tier 4 student, your sponsorship is through the university. And the same goes for Tier 2 and Tier 5 staff. So if you're a Tier 2, Tier 5 staff on those visas, you're also tied to the institution. And if your contract ends, or you've been made redundant as a result of COVID, you'll also find yourself in having an immigration situation. And so for these students, they're being basically told they have to pay their tuition fees, and all of them who have contacted us have told us, in effect, they cannot pay their tuition fees because their parents have also been made redundant in the countries that they reside in. So this has become a real issue. And so a lot of these students have received these very threatening letters. So the second letter that we put out is primarily aimed at universities and basically demanding that there should be a tuition fee amnesty for however long COVID, any of the COVID lockdowns happen, whether it's in the UK or whether it's in their respective countries. So I think it's really important that we kind of look at it from that perspective. One of the things is that we also know with Tier 4 students who are obviously PhD students, is that because of the COVID situation, is that, a lot of them have also either, you know, had their teaching hours being taken away from them, or, and with that, basically, it means they have, like, no option to get other work, because at the moment, it's really hard to get work anywhere. But at the same time, it could also, if your teaching is tied to other things, it might lead to an interruption as a result of your PhD. So if your teaching is tied, or any type of, let's say, lab work or anything like that is tied to something related to your PhD, it might mean that you'd have to interrupt your PhD for that, you know, because you cannot do the work required as part of your PhD. So that might mean you'll have to leave the country, but that also presents its own complications. And we're also concerned about Tier 2 and Tier 5 staff who might be laid off because of the coronavirus, and what that also might be for them, given the situation at the moment. And I think maybe some of you are aware of the fact that just very recently, I think about less than 24 hours ago, the United States has said that any international student studying in the United States, if they're on courses that have been primarily now designated as online courses because of coronavirus, it would have to leave the country. So we're not entirely sure of the situation in the UK, whether the Home Office will follow suit with a similar thing, as what's been happening in the US. So we're just really sort of kind of figuring out things as they come along. I know that at the end of this month, the Home Office will put out another statement concerning COVID and migrant visa holders. So I think we'll know then what the status of Tier 4 students will be. But one last point, and I think we'll just end on that, this note, is that for the last 2 months, URBC has put out a COVID technology and monitoring study. And we really want to know exactly where all of the apps are going and how they're being designated. So I think last push, the study will end on the 24th of this month. So Friday, the 24th of July. So I would hope that people would continue to plug this, especially because we're using something like Zoom this evening. But we have no idea how this will be used in terms of lecture capture, but also your copyright, all of these issues. I think we just want to know a little bit more in order to help UCU, but other unions who might be facing similar issues as well.
So great. Thank you so much, Sanaz. Okay, so our next speaker is David Renton. David is a radical barrister, and he's going to talk a little bit about that. And David, you're muted.
Oh, can you hear me? Cool, all right. I don't want to talk about being a barrister. It's the most boring thing in the world. And if anyone thinks they're going to win anything in work by going to a tribunal, let's be absolutely clear. Cases right now are not getting listed. If someone was dismissed tomorrow and they wanted to bring a claim to the employment tribunal, it would be heard, I think, realistically, January 2022 at the earliest. So that's not a solution. I'm going to be talking about the law and how you use the law, but I'm going to be talking about it from a perspective of bargaining and from a perspective of negotiating and winning things in your own workplace. The other thing I want to say, just by way of prelude, is that when I read the pledge, I thought it was an extremely interesting and sophisticated document, because it seemed to me to do a number of things. Firstly, it was realistic. It grasped that the situation in universities is going to be one in which lots of people are facing redundancies. Yes, that's inevitable. Secondly, it seemed to me that it posited at least two groups of people. Firstly, a set of people who are casualised workers, and secondly, another set of people who are permanent workers. Now, unlike the vast majority of unionised organising you see, it seemed to me anyway, it actually seemed to think about the relationship between the two and grasped a very important essential truth, which is that if you as an employer turn around and just dismiss dozens, hundreds, your entire casualised teaching bank of staff, then that's going to mean an enormous increase in workload for the permanent members of staff. Now, in the talk that follows, the few minutes I'm going to speak to this, I'm really going to be, as we're addressing the question, which is, if someone came to my chambers and said, I'm a permanent member of staff in that situation, what are my rights? I'm going to be addressing them, but I'm not addressing them in the sense that only permanent staff count. I'm addressing them also to say, as it were, to the people listening to this call who aren't permanent members of staff, who are in a casualised situation, what, as it were, can you be demanding of your colleagues who are permanent staff? What realistically could be that could they be arguing in relation to their employer? So I'm going to make three points. The second and third will overlap with certain things that Shelley said earlier, but I'll start with something which I think for me is the starting point. It's this. A very large number of people who are permanent teaching staff in the higher education sector are employed on contracts which put an absolute cap, a ceiling, on the total number of hours they can work. Obviously, this is an important factor within the new university sector, the post-1992 universities, where you have, in principle, I have no idea how well it's still maintained locally, how well people have been able to defend it, but in principle, there's an absolute cap on the amount of hours which a permanent member of teaching staff can do, which is 18 hours a week or 550 hours a year. Now, where someone has got that absolute cap, what I want to convey, because people sometimes are quite naive about this, we often say, oh, you know, employment contracts, surely employers can vary them at will. From the point of view of judges and the courts, without in any way trying to pretend that the courts are nicer than they are in reality, but from the point of view of how we see contract law, you cannot be made to work to a bargain if the other side proposes to renegotiate it midway through. We don't see any difference between a worker, for example, and someone, say, buying a sports car for £30,000. So, all right, well, I was planning to pay £30,000, but you know what, midway through, I've changed my mind, I'm now going to buy it for £10,000. Sorry, you can't vary the contract after it's been made. No one party can unilaterally vary the contract. And that's exactly the attitude the courts take towards this cap, where you have it, of no more than 18 hours a week, no more than 550 a year. Now, I've talked about the new universities. Obviously, there's a different situation in the old universities, but in quite a number of them, you have often slightly more complicated systems, but which deliver the same result. So, number one, if I was representing or working with permanent members of staff who are trying to prevent a deluge of increased work and overwork, I'd be starting by trying to bargain collectively and enforce a contractual term which employers are not entitled to vary. They cannot without your consent. And that would be my starting point. The reason for starting there, of course, is it's collective. The other things I'm going to talk about, and they'll overlap with certain things which Shelley said, are individual. But you start with the collective, it seems to me, rather than the individual. All right, the second thing I want to say, and I'll try and do this, the other two both in a minute each. Yes, focus on discrimination, but I want to put this slightly differently from Shelley. Shelley said, look at the redundancies which are being made and put in discrimination questionnaires to identify if women, black people and so on are substantially affected. Yes, good approach. But that's not what I'm saying is the most effective approach if we focus on the rights of permanent workers. Grasp. For the permanent workers who are seeing an increase in the hours, almost inevitably, there's going to be some discriminatory aspect to how that increase is done. I do every day of my working life cases where bankers are told, all right, oh, by the way, you've all got to do 10% more work, and a team of 30 people. In that team of 30 people, it is never, ever, ever the case that everyone gets the same increase in their hours. In universities, we know there's an enormous inequality in practice of power between the senior man who's been there 30 years, who's already a reader or a professor, the more junior woman who only got tenure 3 or 5 years ago. You know that there will be sex discrimination claims, race discrimination claims, age discrimination claims, just there. And the point is, by raising grievances about them, you can absolutely gum up the system and make it practically impossible for your employer to shift the workload, to cascade the work, to allocate it from fixed term to permanent members of staff. So yes, discrimination, but look at the discriminatory impact on the people who are remaining in the workplace. There's an awful lot of practical that can be done with that. The last point, and I've circulated the link to section 44. Look, the reason why I put this last is that I know that in universities, no one wants to be stress Spartacus. Really. You're putting your body on the line and saying you're declaring things about yourself personally, and that you're forcing it to be dealt with individually, and it's a weak bargaining situation to be in. So I get that it's a rare position to be in, and in truth, if you could present a case more in terms of disability discrimination and reasonable adjustment, you'd have a lot more power in the workplace. But there are a group of people with health conditions and so on, who would be able to turn around and say, as Shelley indicated, the test is employee facing, reasonably believing, a serious and imminent threat to their health? That doesn't have to be a nervous breakdown. You know, that could be someone who's got Crohn's and who just physically isn't capable of increasing their hours from 15 a week to 25, if you bear in mind that each of those teaching hours has behind it another twice again in terms of preparation and so on. There are an awful lot of people, and there are also a lot of people who possibly wouldn't meet the threshold for disability. You've got the protection of Section 44. And of course, what Section 44 does, and I'll only try and do a couple of sentences, it doesn't just allow for the collective walkout from work. If you read the text carefully, which I sent you, what it allows the employee to take appropriate steps, whatever they are, in response to the risk of health and safety danger. And that might simply be turning around and say, you know what, I've always worked 15 hours a week. I'm absolutely refusing to do more than 15 hours a week. This is just me taking appropriate steps to protect myself from danger. And, you know, Section 44 does give you quite a lot of protection in that situation. So I'll leave it there.
Perfect. Thank you, Dave. And then our last initial speaker is going to be Fazi Ismail. And I'll hand it over to you, Fazi.
So sorry, I'm late. I thought it was at 6:30. Okay, so I've been asked to speak about Goldsmiths as well as SOAS. I teach at both places on a 0.5. And just to say, we have been at Goldsmiths, associate lecturers and graduate trainee tutors have been on a marking boycott for several weeks. And then some of the lecturers on fixed term contracts joined them. And we ended the marking boycott just recently, just last week, when the local UCU branch voted to declare an intention to call a dispute if the college didn't give us the equalities impact assessment that they promised that they would undertake by Friday. And it doesn't look like they will, in which case we will move to a ballot in the next couple of weeks. So we're committing ourselves to calling a local dispute. Now, the overriding kind of solidarity actions was really getting permanent lecturers to write letters of support, and this came from several departments, but also in those letters publicly refusing to take on our work. And so wherever we can, I think we have to continue to put that moral pressure on them. And also something that really helped was getting out those letters as soon as possible. So I just wanted to sort of briefly talk about some of the things that there were sort of small victories during that boycott. So the permanent lecturers did refuse in many cases in at least three or four departments to refuse to cover our work on health and safety grounds. And of course, you know, Dave has said there's legislation on all of this. And I think they were well aware of that, and they were using that. Several statements of support were published, extraordinary statement from colleagues in the art department, including one lecturer who refused to basically withdrew their labor. We had a virtual picket, which we kind of went out all out on Twitter about, and we got various kind of tweets of support, and that was a big thing. I mean, we were trending in London. You know, we got a lot of support out of that, and that was very useful. We got some media coverage as well out of that from the Times Higher Tribune, various art websites, New Statesman, Guardian, and so on. And we got a meeting with the senior management, which they didn't, you know, which they weren't agreeing to give us in the first place. So, and we have got some movement, we think, on extending some of our contracts. So they have been shifting. The union was also very crucial to our action. So they helped us in a lot of ways, even though it was an unofficial action, by, you know, instructing or suggesting that permanent colleagues don't cover our work. And they sort of created this feeling that our demands were legitimate, even though they couldn't back the action officially. And you know, it was 2 weeks at least for, several weeks over the marking boycott, and nobody's going to lose pay, and nobody's going to be disciplined. So that was also a victory. So we had this kind of organizational infrastructure amongst the casual staff. It was autonomous, but it was heavily supported and linked to the union that gave us a kind of platform and promoted what we were doing effectively. So in a way, they did get around you know, the anti-union laws, and moving to a dispute was obviously key. Now we're also talking of an official marking boycott, possibly in August, to boycott the resits, possible recruitment, clearing, and all of that. So and as well, we got some of those people who were leading in the marking boycott onto the union exec as a kind of anti-casualization committee. So that's really good, and they've got, you know, some facility time and so on. I just wanted to say a few words about SOAS, which is a slightly different situation, of course, in a much worse situation financially. 127 redundancies, possibly in professional services, so the admin side, possibly 56 redundancies on the academic side. But again, we're not getting the information, and I think that's been something that a lot of us who are organizing at different universities are facing. We're just not getting the transparency that we want from management. The organigrams that they've put out recently look very bad. It's a sort of total restructuring of management, not necessarily in terms of size, but in terms of, you know, we got rid of faculties a few years ago. Now it looks like they're bringing them back in a different way. But the real contraction is the departmental support for academic staff and students. The thing that we most want is contracting. The thing that we least want in terms of management is not contracting. And we're just trying to find ways of leverage at SOAS because, you know, we have had 5 years of relentless attacks on our working conditions. And so it's not going to come at the moment from academics. It will come hopefully from the professional services side. So, you know, we're trying to sort of make the argument amongst academics that you will need support. This will be a huge attack on your working conditions if the support for your work is greatly diminished. And so the professional services side is thinking of shutting down the school for 2 weeks starting on the 20th of July, and hopefully we'll get some support from the academic side as well. But we're going to put out a series of demands tomorrow. They'll be around, you know, cuts to indirect costs, pushing back on the business school that they want to get going. You know, pushing them on the kind of vision they have for SOAS, making sure that, again, we have these equalities impacts assessments on how they're going to affect fractional staff in particular, and the cleaners. I mean, I didn't quite realize this. A third of cleaners have already been made redundant during the pandemic. And now what they're doing with the restructuring is, after this 12-year long campaign to get better conditions for cleaners and get them in-house, management looks like they're going to reverse that and just outsource them again, and not even have you know, things like catering, they want to completely just basically get rid of. So we're trying to push back, particularly on these things where they've got legal obligations around health and safety, around workload, around equalities impact assessments. We're going to have a public meeting. We're going to have actually, so the UCU branch is meeting, is has a branch meeting tomorrow to vote on a motion on no compulsory redundancies. And if we win that, we will move then again in a couple of weeks to declaring a local dispute. And so tomorrow, the professional services sort of staff and activists, and hopefully it'll be big, have made a big banner, and they will have a physical protest outside the branch meeting to say, you know, no SOAS without us, to kind of give our academic colleagues some confidence that actually, you know, this we are really all in this together. It's now time to talk about solidarity across the board. Nobody is safe, not even if you have a permanent contract. And I think that's the thing that we have to keep getting across, that the precarity is becoming generalized across the sector. So casualized staff need to work with admin, need to work with cleaners, need to work with permanent academics, across this range of issues, and say, you know, this is not the kind of marketized model we want. We absolutely have to reject it.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much, Faizy. So we're going to hopefully take, we have time for like a question or two from the audience. I know people have been posting stuff in the chat, but if anyone has a question for one of the speakers that they think would be useful for everybody else to hear answered, obviously you can follow up one-on-one, but it would be if we could take a question or two from the floor, and then we'll do some breakout groups to discuss further, that would be...
Yeah, if you can use the raise hand feature, then we can...
Okay, cool. So I see... hand from Christina. Anybody else?
Christina.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Cool. We've got. Let's do those two questions. Then we'll do a question from Christina and then a question from Carlos. Sorry, Christina. Yeah.
Oh, so shall I go?
Yep.
Yeah. So it was really a question to Shelley and to some extent Dave as well. Because one of the biggest problems is the mental health of precarious staff, and I have witnessed this over and over and over again and suffered it myself. When you're told, when you're told that you might have hours, or the hours will be allocated like sometime in September, and you have to wait 4 or 5 months to know whether you're going to have hours or not. That stress that happens every year, basically, but is increased this year because we know that everything's going to be cut. For a lot of people, they don't even know whether they're going to get any hours. And the mental health impact on that is phenomenal. I mean, I have experienced it myself. I know loads of people who have. Is there a way that we can use the regulations that you were talking about to fight that, to fight on that basis?
Cool. Okay. So I guess Shelley and or Dave, if you want to respond to that.
Mental health detriment, yeah.
I think Dave's already started speaking, but he's muted. Go on.
I was asking if you wanted to go first.
Oh, no, you go.
Well, I see it differently perhaps from Shelley, because her work focuses on health and safety, whereas I'm an individual employment lawyer. I tend to think that it's I don't particularly like claims for damages arising after mental health damage. I don't think they're particularly strong. I think that the damages people get once you're in the legal system are way worse than people think. I think there probably are legal routes, but they're legal routes which haven't really been properly explored yet. But where you'd get into them is really by people winning claims either for disability discrimination or for discrimination as part-time workers or under the fixed-term regulations. Once you get into the establishment that someone suffered harm under any of those different heads, disability, fixed-term, part-time, whatever, with the courts immediately start saying, well, what's the detriment? And we just need to win some cases. UCU needs to do a bit of strategic litigation, backing up people who've got strong cases. I can see some people nodding who are in that situation.
I have
who
to ought to be getting proper well, support so, yeah.
from the union. And
they don't.
But the point is that yeah. it's very hard to get the employer to recognise this till we've had some of these cases win. And we can say, look, that person, it was recognised as a detriment. People grasped that was an additional element of harm, and it led bluntly to an extra 10 or 20k worth of damages or whatever. Sometimes you just got to go out for and fight those strategic cases, even when bits of the union are nervous about doing it. I'm saying in case anyone's listening.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Amazing.
In terms of the management controls I was mentioning, that come about through doing the risk assessments in the first place and including stress in those risk assessments is the HSE's stress management controls. And I mentioned before that the second one they mention is about how much control do you have over your working practices, which when you're precarious, you're waiting every year to find out how much work you've got, if you've got any work at all, is obviously a key concern. And that's probably why so few universities have taken this up. I don't know whether you meant, when you said action, whether you meant legal action or industrial action or maybe both. Obviously, in taking any other kind of action is much harder when you are precarious, which I think is why it's so important that you guys have this initiative, which is about putting some pressure on on the university, your permanent colleagues who are able to exert a little bit more of that. I hope both of us have answered your question a little bit, at least.
A little bit, yeah. That's great. Thank you.
Great. Okay, so we've got another question from Carlo. And Carlo, go ahead.
Carlo Murray at Dundee here. It's a question really to Faisy, if she could say a little bit more about how the letters for permanent staff developed, and if you can share them and say a little bit more about that. The reason being, at Dundee, we voted at our union meeting yesterday with two abstentions. It was unanimous. To declare a dispute linking the issues of the refusal to confirm contract extension for fixed-term workers with workloads, with proposed pay cuts, and potential redundancies from October. I think that was a really big step forward in terms of trying to get people to understand that this is, as Faisy was saying, this is a real attack on everybody's conditions of work, not just one group, and we have to respond collectively in that. I just want to flag up at the Higher Education Committee on Friday, we've got the statement from the Solidarity Movement calling for a national campaign emulating what the National Education Union is doing in terms of their mass meetings, and calling on Joe Grady to the General Secretary to start initiating that kind of activity. Because I do think the National Union has been woeful in its response over the past few weeks and months. We've got to force the union into backing campaigns and encouraging branches like mine who are declaring a dispute to find a way of collectivising this nationally. If it's just Dundee, if it's just Sowers, if it's just Roehampton, Imperial and Goldsmith fighting this individually, we will be in a much weaker position than if we get a national response and a national campaign. And I think that's why the opening statements about the four fights is really important. It gives us an opportunity to try and put a national fight over jobs and casualisation back onto the agenda. And I think when that consultation emerges, we've got to do all we can to maximise the vote to reject the yep. fourth so-called offer.
Great. Cheers. Faisy, do you have a response?
I can definitely share the letters of support, and I think that's useful, and I'm sure they'd be fine with that. The art department put out an extraordinary, I mean, it was a moving letter of support. They named each of the six fixed-term contract people in their department, and they talked about how they contributed to the department just as everybody else does. I mean, it was extraordinary. And five of those six people are Black women. It was very good. Media also put out a statement, and as well, I think it was Anthropology, and then various and quite quickly as well, which we thought was really important. And then other departments like politics put out an official, like a tweet from their official account, basically, which we didn't even know about. So it kind of, you know, caught on. And then various people were various kind of centers and institutes and whatnot were putting out, tweets of support and kind of statements of support. The other thing I should say that was really important was at Goldsmiths was the Professors Forum. So there is this thing called the Professors Forum, and they put out kind of three or four very strong statements linking the what's happening in higher education to the Black Lives Matter movement, to recognizing structural racism within the university and how this is unacceptable and all that stuff. And they were actually have been quite instrumental in stopping some of the restructuring at Goldsmiths. I mean, of course, they're coming back for more, but they actually stopped the so-called Evolving Goldsmiths project in its tracks. So not just the professor's forum, but they were quite instrumental in doing that. So, you know, at SOAS, we were thinking, could we write to the professors literally and just say, you know, this is what they're doing at Goldsmiths. Maybe you want to get together and maybe put out a statement or kind of, you know, do something. And it's not that, you know, I mean, there can be, I think, some moral pressure sort of put on that. We haven't quite done that yet, but we're trying to do other things. I forgot to say in my introduction, the casual staff are also going to launch a collective grievance, and this is something that we've been talking about for a while, which actually gets together students as well as sympathetic permanent staff and whoever wants to get involved. So we're in the middle of doing a survey at the moment. It's a 2-week survey to really get to grips with the latest kind of attack on conditions. And we're going to draw out of that 5 or 6 paradigmatic cases, highlight them in a document and have a kind of, I mean, I was thinking what would be good is to have a sort of public hearing to demand to the school that, look, we want you to listen to us. If you don't listen to us, because the school always says, oh, we can't discuss individual cases because of confidentiality reasons. And we are saying, this is not confidential, this is political. You know, we want to tell you about what's really happening in terms of our conditions, and then kind of invite everybody across the SOAS community, so students, cleaners, sympathetic members of staff, and so on, to have this hearing and to hear these cases, and obviously in the context of the wider casualization, but again to make this point that nobody is safe, that really we are trying to defend the sector.
Okay, great. Sanaz had one more comment, and then we're going to go to the breakout groups. So, Sanaz, if we could just...
I think picking up on what Faizy just mentioned, I think, you know, any type of successful campaign has to involve all types of individuals, workers, up to students, up to staff, either casual or permanent. One thing I want to mention, and maybe I'm trying to make this very, very quick, is that prior to COVID and everything else, during the previous UCU strike a couple of months ago, many URBC members were touring around different campuses, and some of the prevailing thoughts of fighting the hostile environment inside higher education was that universities should pay for the visa fees for tier 2 visa holders and the NHS surcharge fees, again, for tier 2 visa holders. We as URBC maintain that's a really bad position for a number of reasons, and primarily because we have seen how universities began to weaponize strike action against tier 2 visa holders and tier 5 visa holders. So I think on one hand, you know, if a university is paying your visa fees or NHS surcharge fees or both, that can be used as a noose to prevent you from actually striking, because they can use that in a way. And the other thing is that it's not showing solidarity to those who are impacted within your community. We've always supported the docs not cops position, which is, of course, patients not passports. We urge you to look at that position. We think that the fight against, NHS surcharge fees or the fight against exploitative visa fees has to always be, you know, remind us of those who are impacted from it in the most violent of ways, which is, of course, asylum seekers, undocumented people, and anyone else who's having immigration problems, who is working class primarily. So I think it's about showing solidarity to those individuals and using your position in that way. So the fight against hostile environment, these are not, we can't think of just winnable campaigns. We have to think about the systemic issues at play. The other point I just want to briefly mention is that there have been campaigns, actually with tier 4 students and at Goldsmiths in particular with their wildcat strikes, but also at the Pause or Pay campaign. A number of arts colleges were going on a tuition fee strike, and a number of those individuals were Tier 4 students. So I think if Tier 4 students were willing to put themselves on the line, that could potentially put themselves in a situation of becoming undocumented in some situations because of their visa, their sponsorship tied to the university. I think that Tier 2 and Tier 5 staff need to go above and beyond because your Tier 4 students are doing it at the moment.
Okay, great. So we're gonna split up into breakout rooms for about 15 minutes. And just, we thought this would be like a useful time for people to be able to kind of brainstorm a little bit more specifically. And Jordan has
I'm just gonna share with the chat. So we have a few questions that we were hoping people could discuss in breakout rooms. And so we'll put you in them for, I think we'll keep it to 12 minutes so that we have enough time for everything else. And if you could appoint a participant in the breakout room to just share one or two points that emerge from that room afterwards, that would be great. So the questions that we have to discuss, and I'll share these in the chat, are: what are the barriers to resisting management in your local context? How can you bring your colleagues on board? And how can you organize locally to resist the Four Fights offer? So this is an opportunity for people to speak to one another in small groups, talk about your local situation, and think about basically how you can organize to address these issues.
Activist groups. Another issue that, another factor that somebody raised in the group was something that's going on at Manmet, where permanent staff are reading out the stories of casualized staff as videos that can be used to sort of build awareness of the campaign and the various demands that have been put forward.
Great, thanks. That's really helpful. Mark Taylor, would you like to speak next?
Yeah, we were talking about so I'm based in Edinburgh, but we're talking about the power of social media and other communication platforms like WhatsApp, for example. We've seen a lot of positions where members are sharing opinions and talking way more than they used to, and expressing thoughts and worries. Zoom meetings as well that become almost toolbox talks I talk about toolbox talks, I'm a civil engineer, but in terms of members are more inclined to attend these meetings now, and whichever topic they are generally more inclined. I mean, we've seen, so I represent the EIS at Edinburgh Napier University, I'm the co-convener of the branch for next community, we've seen huge amounts of attendance and engagement with Facebook pages, WhatsApp groups, and it's been really powerful and helpful. And we're talking about the how very quickly we became aware of the issues at SOAS and Goldsmiths, and the because of the social media use, if you like, and that was powerful. So I think in terms of resistance as well, and resistant management, one of the things we were talking about was, instead of the financial information that's often thrown at reps and branch conveners, just ask some very simple questions. You don't need to be a chartered accountant to pick apart some of the lies and some of the lack of information that's been provided. Anyway, that's us, I think.
Great. Thanks so much. I'm just conscious of time. I think now might be a good chance, since Ellen and Barbara haven't spoken yet, if we could invite them to contribute, and then we can finish up with the rest of the breakout rooms. So Ellen, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, we have Ellen and Barbara here from Labor Notes in the US, who are just gonna talk a little bit.
Yeah, a pleasure and an honor to be in this space with all of you. And I'll just be very brief. Barbara Mataloni and I are colleagues on Labor Notes. Some of you may be aware of what it is. It's a 40-year-old project in the United States, a media and education project that is devoted to the rank and file, militant, democratic, class struggle side of the labor movement in the US. These have been 40 years of extreme despair and desperation for workers in every possible way, including the constant and unending suppression of both economic conditions and our rights to organize and our confidence in our ability to organize and fight. And what we are seeing now is that these extreme, overwhelming challenges that are resulting from stage of this just this disintegration of neoliberal capitalism, if you will, is that the austerity impositions on all of us, particularly in education, and both Barbara and I have worked for decades in this field, are making people be willing to do things that they have not been willing to do for some time. So I think the first thing that I'd like to say from what I heard in this call and what I heard in the breakout room that I was in is, please be confident in the potential and the possibility of your coworkers to take leaps in their willingness to act collectively and act in solidarity and act despite their fear, because everyone is going to be afraid. Everyone should be afraid, because what's coming down the road at all of us is going to be devastating. It will be devastating for all of us as individual workers. It will be devastating for our students. It will be devastating for the entire system of higher education in the UK, in the US, and everywhere. So be confident in that. And as a practical matter, and we were invited onto the call because I believe that we're going to be doing some organizing training for some of you or all of you. I'm not sure that's getting shaped up now. But I'd like to leave you with a question. How many of you know and can get in touch with your colleagues at your university on whatever platform is possible for discussions within your department or within your school? Is it possible in this period of time? You can't walk down the hall and knock on people's doors. Can you find them? Do you have access to them through email or through phone numbers? And how many of you are engaging in discussions with your colleagues in your own university about the matters of extreme urgency that you're facing? Because we consider that the basis of all potentially powerful union resistance. Barbara?
Well, what can I say? Hi. Delightful to meet you all. I'm afraid I just hopped on because I apparently have conversion problems when it comes to time zones. So I apologize that I missed the conversation. But I guess I just want to say that, like, in terms of what Ellen has framed as the possibilities, that I've been fortunate myself to be able in the last 6 years to be able to live some of those possibilities in the midst of a moment even 6 years ago when here in the U.S. it seemed like entirely unlikely that there would be the kinds of uprising that we've seen, first from educators and now with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so, like, what I would bring to this conversation, besides my work with Labor Notes, and my work with educators in both K-12 and higher education here in the U.S., is my experience as president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, which is a 117,000 member union in Massachusetts that represents K-12 educators and higher education. And being elected out of a progressive caucus and with the support of Labor Notes and the organizing and consulting that they did with me, really being able to transform the union into a place where people were, like, actively demanding that they be able to use their power to transform both their locals and our state statewide association. Winning a really big ballot question in the U.S. In Massachusetts, where they the privatizers attempted to increase the number of what we call charter schools. I think you call them academies in England, and we were able to mount a statewide campaign and just crush them. Even though they were winning in March, we crushed them in November. And we did that by, I think in terms of the lessons of, Ellen saying, like, how many people can you talk to can you bring them together for a discussion? What we did was we got people talking to each other in both formal and informal ways to understand what was happening with the charter question and to access, by coming together to name the problem together and identify the problem together, to in those moments come to realize their power if we were act collectively. And so I have a just in my bones understanding about the possibilities of our work. And I'm excited to work with you to share that. And I just will also say I have a network here in the US, the Public Higher Education Workers, that has been active for more than a year now, looking at how to grow rank and file militant democratic unions. And we've been especially active since the pandemic hit. And at some point, I'd like to invite some of you onto that call. I think some conversations, shared conversations about how do we organize and the particular challenges of organizing within higher education, I think are things that would be really valuable for us to share. So yeah, I'm delighted to get to know you all the next time we meet.
Okay, great. And I think some of us are going to try to propose that these conversations continue into some of the anti-casualization committee trainings and training conference that is coming forward. So this is kind of like a taster session. It's very, very obvious that we need to keep talking to each other and keep talking to our colleagues and also keep talking and coordinating across universities and also across and colleges and across regions. However, we want to keep to time, so we're going to wrap up. We will give you guys a few things coming away from this tonight. We are going to do the audio recording, which we will give you. We are going to take all the signatures from Corona Contract and from the Permanent Staff Pledge, and we'll organize it by institution so that you can identify the people from your institution that you might already know or you might not know, who you can reach out to, who've already signed some document saying that they want to organize or are in support of this. So that's hopefully something that you can take away. And we'll take away all the useful stuff from the chat and email that to you. So that hopefully will be tonight. It might be a little late tonight. It might be really early tomorrow morning, depending on how quickly I can get around, you know, all the tech. But that's what we're going to do. And then as a very last thing, the RCA in 2 minutes is going to be having a rally. A short online rally, 10-15 minutes, to announce the results of a vote of no confidence in their vice chancellor, which is going to be their next step in potentially ramping up towards the dispute. So Kevin Biederman and folks at the RCA invite you all. Jordan, if you could post that, great. Jordan just posted that in the chat. So if you want to come along to that, it's just another 10 or 15 minutes out of your day to support the RCA and to support those workers who are on some of the most egregious contracts, or rather terms of engagement, not even contracts, in UK higher education. It's really, really despicable. And the RCA people have been, you know, doing everything they can to fight back. So thank you all for coming tonight. And this is just the beginning, but hopefully this has given you a little bit more confidence in terms of thinking about how you can implement some of these things around the Permanent Staff Pledge at your own institutions. So we'll see you at the next rally.
See you at the rally.